Fly High, you probably already know, it's called Fly High. Yeah. It's probably the only English part of that song. At 112 BPM, it's actually really, it's got a real disco feeling to it. It's by The Escalators. Before that, One More Time by Secret Cruise from the album Tell You What from 1996. And by the way, Fly High is from 1994. Before that, In Your Love by Natsuko from the album Misty Love. That one was from 1992 as well. Up next, we're going to have something a little more modern. This one's, if I get it correctly, it is from 2015. This one's called Ano Hito by Futari no Bungaku. Amazing song. Absolutely love the horn section arrangement right there. Well, if you have enjoyed this program for how many minutes? Oh, it's 40 minutes already. If you enjoy the music over the last 40 minutes, you might just as well check out our other offerings. There is Record Roulette. Give vinyl from our record library a spin. Listen to Record Roulette Thursdays at 10:30 p.m. only on WRCT. If I have one sentence to comment to that, is that we definitely have a great, great vinyl collection. Definitely tune in at 10:30 p.m. That is, or Liminal Dune cutting-edge soundscapes explore the auditory frontier with Silver Spiral on Liminal Dune, airing Tuesdays from 4 to 5 p.m. exclusively on WCT Pittsburgh. Alright, it's time to get back to the music. This one's called In the Wind by The Indigo. From the year 2003. Heard Lisa Yamamoto with Juichi Natsuno Natsu or November Summer. Before that, that song was called Truth by Uni Style. That was from 2010. Before that, In the Wind by The Indigo from the album Glider. That one was from 2003. Got a good mix of vintage and modern here, if you call the 1980s vintage, which I do since I was born in 2004, so I guess that, you know, sort of makes some sense. But anyway, well, since this is the end of the program, I'll have to do some announcements. This one is from Allegheny County Emergency Management Council. Are you in an emergency? Call 911 if you can. Text if you cannot. Southwestern Pennsylvania wireless customers can send an SMS text message to a 911 operator from a mobile device when they cannot place a phone call. This feature allows people with hearing or speech impairments, as well as those in situations where it is unsafe to speak on the phone, to contact 911 operators. If you text 911, only send text messages. Multimedia files cannot be received by 911 operators. In the to field, enter the numerals 911. In the message, include the address / location of the emergency and the type of help needed. Fire, police, ambulance. Click send and be prepared to answer questions that follow instructions from the 911 operator. If you need to, place your phone on silent so as not to alert intruders. Remember, do not text and drive and use 911 services only in an emergency. Use an agency regular phone lines or a non-emergency call. Well, we are approaching the 56th minute of the show, and well, good time sure doesn't last long. I really do enjoy playing shows every week. I really do, you know. This is the music that I love, and I'm here to bring them to you. So, well, if you want to hear more of this program, you could always tune into WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM at 10 to 11 p.m. on Saturday night. I think I have time to slip in one more, and this one is very, very romantic. This one's called Class of 88 by Yasuyuki Ide. Thank you. DJ Lee here at WHCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. I hope you have a very good rest of your weekend as well as a very good next week. And good luck to those who are taking exams, because I definitely am here at CMU. So that's it. Good night. DJ Lee signing off. This one's Class of 88 from 1995.
Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we begin by interviewing constitutional law scholar Professor Marjorie Cohen about the likely impact of some recent and shockingly conservative U.S. Supreme Court rulings.
Professor Cohen also describes some of the radical proposals contained in the now much discussed Project 2025. And what it would mean for the lives of most Americans if we were under a new Trump administration. Now on Law and Disorder, instead of the big picture, we look at opposition to Israel's war in Gaza from a very singular and very personal point of view.
We'll do so by talking with Larry Hebert, a 26-year-old U.S. Air Force airman, about his protest and hunger strike in opposition to that war.
Stay with us.
Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
The U.S. Constitution created three branches of the federal government to serve as a check on one another. In particular, the judiciary was intended to ensure that the actions of the executive and legislative branches did not violate the Constitution. But what happens when the Supreme Court is in the grip of a highly partisan, result-oriented supermajority, half of whom were appointed by a president who has been convicted of 34 felonies and faces 57 more felony charges in three different criminal prosecutions, but claims absolute immunity for whatever he did while in office. And on top of that, this ex-president, Donald Trump, is a nominee for president of the United States and has promised to terminate the Constitution. Meanwhile, in an almost 1,000-page blueprint entitled Project 2025, Mandate for Leadership, The Conservative Promise, a group of conservative organizations spearheaded by the Heritage Foundation has laid out a detailed plan under which the president would acquire almost dictatorial power over the entire federal government. To discuss the Supreme Court, Project 2025, and how we can fight back, we've turned to an expert who is no stranger to law and disorder, Marjorie Cohn. She was a co-host of Law and Disorder for 2.5 years and has been a guest several times. Marjorie is a professor of law emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, and is also dean of the People's Academy of International Law and a member of the Bureau of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. She writes frequent articles about the Supreme Court and other topics for Truth Out. Marjorie, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much, Steve and Jim.
Marjorie, since former President Donald Trump appointed three right-wingers to the Supreme Court, thereby solidifying a six-person conservative supermajority, the court has issued several reactionary rulings. What do you consider the most egregious recent rulings of the Supreme Court, and why do you think they pose a threat to our constitutional democracy?
Well, Steve, I have to say it's hard to whittle down what the worst are because there are so many terrible ones. But of course, last term, the Supreme Court overruled the Roe v. Wade decision in Dobbs and held there's no constitutional right to abortion. Now, they wrote that nothing in the opinion should cast doubt on precedents that don't concern abortion, but the dissenters were not convinced. They said no one should be confident that this majority is done with its work, and the right to abortion enshrined in Roe is part of the same constitutional fabric as the rights to contraception and same-sex marriage and intimacy. And they wrote, either the mass of the majority's opinion is hypocrisy, or additional constitutional rights are under threat. It's one or the other. Well, Clarence Thomas wrote in his concurrence that the court should reconsider the right to contraception, to same-sex sexual conduct, and the right to same-sex marriage. Then we have a 6-3 ruling with the reactionary supermajority of the court, ruling in Department of State versus Munoz, basically that U.S. citizens have no constitutional right to have their non-citizen spouses enter the U.S., so the government doesn't have to give a reason for excluding them, and that places the right to marriage equality squarely on the chopping block. Then we have City of Grants Pass, Oregon versus Johnson, another 6-3 atrocity, where the Supreme Court upheld ordinances in a southwest Oregon city that prohibit people who are homeless from using blankets, pillows, or cardboard boxes for protection from the elements while sleeping within the city limits. And Sotomayor wrote the dissent on behalf of her and Kagan and Jackson that this leaves the most vulnerable in our society with an impossible choice, either stay awake or be arrested. Then the six reactionary members of the court put the final nail in the coffin of the Chevron case, which dramatically curtailed the part of federal agencies to interpret the statutes they administer. The court ruled that courts should provide their own interpretations of ambiguous statutes. And this decision will imperil the rights of workers and consumers and threaten the environment and our health and safety, all while providing a boon to corporations. Courts have used this Chevron deference to uphold a National Labor Relations Board decision that certain workers constitute employees entitled to the protection of the National Labor Relations Act, to affirm an EPA rule that required states to reduce emissions from power plants, to sustain a Department of Labor interpretation of the Black Lung Benefits Act to allow coal miners with black lung disease to get compensation, and accept the EPA's revised regulations under the Toxic Substances Control Act to provide enhanced protection from lead paint exposure. Now corporations will take aim at labor regulations that protect workers. Banks and financial services companies will weaken consumer protections, and the fossil fuel industry will resist regulations that impact their bottom line. Could affect the way insurance is administered by Medicare, Medicaid, and the Affordable Care Act. And perhaps the most shocking decision was the very recent Trump versus U.S., where the six-member supermajority basically held that U.S. presidents are now kings. Henceforth, a president will have absolute immunity from prosecution for official acts done in the course of carrying out his constitutional powers or implementing a federal statute. And that means, well, Roberts, John Roberts, who wrote the majority opinion, he's the chief, said that the president is absolutely immune from criminal prosecution for conduct within his exclusive sphere of constitutional authority. That includes commanding the armed forces, granting pardons, appointing ambassadors and members of the Supreme Court, overseeing international diplomacy and intelligence gathering, terrorism, trade, and immigration. There is no immunity for unofficial acts, but the majority admitted that it's hard to distinguish official from unofficial acts. So Sotomayor wrote in her dissent on behalf of the three liberals, the court effectively creates a law-free zone around the president. It will lie about like a loaded weapon for any president to use for their own political gain or financial interests, with knowledge that they're inoculated from criminal liability. She wrote that when a president uses his official powers in any way, he'll be immune from criminal prosecution. And then she noted, quote, orders the Navy SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival? Immune. Organizes a military coup to hold on to power? Immune. Takes a bribe in exchange for pardon? Immune, 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 immune. And they also did away with affirmative action and on and on and on, Steve.
Well, Marjorie, Jim Lafferty, good morning to you. Takes your breath away what you've already recited for us, and this is not the end, is it? Because you've also studied Project 2025, which Steve mentioned in his introduction. Tell us, therefore, what you've learned, and in particular, what you've learned in terms of what it has to say about what we might expect from the Supreme Court if Project 2025 does, in fact, become the agenda.
Yes, and I should say, Jim, that Donald Trump, because there's been so much negative publicity about Project 2025, Donald Trump is trying to distance himself from it, saying, oh, I don't even know what it says, although he was intimately involved in the development of it. Basically, Project 2025 is a 920-page blueprint for a second Trump administration. It will target reproductive health care, efforts to remediate the climate crisis, immigrants, unions, civil rights for LGBTQ plus people, and administrative agencies that protect our health and safety. It's sponsored by more than 100 reactionary groups and spearheaded by over a dozen former Trump officials. Now, Trump's former budget director, Russell Vought, who wrote one section of this Project 2025, wrote, quote, "The next administration will face a significant challenge in unwinding policies and procedures that are used to advance radical gender, racial, and equity initiatives under the banner of science." Similarly, the Biden administration's climate fanaticism will need a whole of government unwinding, unquote. So they're taking direct aim at the climate change measures to prevent climate change or to halt it. The four main prongs of this Project 2025 blueprint are, first, restoring the family as the centerpiece of American life. Second, dismantling the administrative state. Third, defending U.S. sovereignty, borders, and bounty. And fourth, securing our God-given individual rights to live freely. So, of course, the Supreme Court, as I said, just overruled Chevron deference, which means now that it's going to be in the hands of the court to determine our protection of health and safety. Courts that Trump has systematically packed with right-wingers and would continue to do so in a second term. So Project 2025 would have Trump reinstitute his so-called Schedule F, which Biden eliminated. That would reclassify 50,000 of the 2 million merit-based civil service employees as political appointees who serve at the pleasure of the president without civil service protection. And basically, there'd be a massive exodus of competence. Scientific research on nuclear power, for example, would be done by incompetence. Project 2025 would strictly limit access to abortion. And Congress wouldn't have to make abortion medication unlawful because Trump's FDA could just withdraw its approval of the drug. Project 2025 advocates the creation of a Department of Life to further the health and well-being of all Americans from conception to natural death. Of course, anti-assisted suicide, anti-abortion. The new administration would explicitly state that abortion does not constitute health care, and Planned Parenthood would be prohibited from receiving Medicaid funds. Project 2025 would have Trump abolish the Department of Education, which he's been spouting now recently during the campaign. And his right-hand man Vogt called the Department of Education the Department of Critical Race Theory. Project 2025 says, quote, "The noxious tenets of critical race theory and gender ideology should be excised from curricula in every public school in the country." Project 2025 would abolish Head Start, the child development program that helps break the cycle of poverty by assisting preschool children of low-income families. It would fund private school vouchers and ban all curricula that teach about slavery. And it would prohibit non-citizens from living in federally assisted housing and oppose any efforts to weaken single-family zoning. So Project 2025 read, "The next conservative president must make the institutions of American civil society hard targets for woke cultural warriors. This starts with deleting the terms sexual orientation and gender identity, diversity, equity, and inclusion," and in parentheses, DEI. They would delete gender, gender equality, gender equity, gender awareness, gender sensitive, abortion, reproductive health, reproductive rights, and any other term used to deprive Americans of their First Amendment rights out of every federal rule, agency regulation, contract, grant regulation, and piece of legislation that exists. Under Project 2025, Trump would carry out mass deportations of undocumented immigrants. He's already said he'd do that. Deploy active duty military personnel and the National Guard to police the border and complete construction of his border wall. When the Attorney General issues a warrant for an undocumented immigrant, the current law says the immigrant may be arrested and detained. This blueprint would change may to must and require arrest and detention. Project 2025 recommends eliminating all initiatives to combat climate change, including dismantling the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which tracks hurricanes. It would eliminate offices in the Department of Energy dedicated to renewable energy and climate and energy research. And finally, it would slash the corporate tax rate and the capital gains tax to benefit wealthy Americans. It would tax employers on workplace benefits that exceed $12,000 per worker annually, which would lead to employers cutting back on benefits, including family health insurance. More than 15 million workers would see their benefits taxed under Project 2025. And finally, Project 2025 doesn't recommend any reforms to the Supreme Court. Why not? Because the right-wing extremists have already taken over the court.
My goodness, Marjorie, listening to you, there is such a dangerous synergy between what the Supreme Court has already done in laying the groundwork for this powerful executive branch and then the Project 2025 saying the quiet part out loud of exactly what this administration would do. The Supreme Court can be the last word on some of these issues unless there are reforms. And Joe Biden has proposed, and Kamala Harris has endorsed, three reforms for the Supreme Court. And we want to spend some time talking about those. First, he favors term limits for members of the high court. What exactly does he recommend? What does the Constitution say about that? And how feasible is his proposal?
Well, on July the 29th, the White House issued a release that said term limits would help ensure that the court's membership changes with some regularity, make timing for court nominations more predictable and less arbitrary, and reduce the chance that any single presidency imposes undue influence for generations to come. And I should say, Steve, that as we all know, Trump installed three radical right-wingers on the court to constitute the six-member supermajority that we have now, more than any in recent memory, more nominations than any president in recent memory. So under Biden's proposal for term limits, the president would appoint a member to the Supreme Court every 2 years, and that member would spend 18 years in active service on the high court. Some legal scholars, such as Berkeley Law Dean Erwin Chemerinsky, have said that current members of the Supreme Court may serve more than 30 years. That's too much power for too long in one person's hand. But he contends that term limits would necessitate a constitutional amendment because Article 3, Section 1 of the Constitution says the judges, both of the supreme and inferior courts, shall hold their offices during good behavior, unquote. Congressional Republicans would oppose amending the Constitution to create term limits, and the amendment process is unwieldy and time-consuming. Constitutional amendments require a request by two-thirds of both houses of Congress or two-thirds of the states at a constitutional convention. Then three-quarters of the state legislatures or three-quarters of conventions convened in each state have to agree to ratify the amendment. But several prominent constitutional scholars disagree with Chemerinsky. For example, the Brennan Center for Justice wrote a comprehensive report that said that 18-year active term limits for members of the court is consistent with the Constitution's text and structure and with the ways in which Congress has long regulated the court, including the existing system of senior judges. And 50 constitutional law professors propose that Congress pass a statute to enact term limits for members of the Supreme Court. Even assuming that term limits could be enacted without a constitutional amendment, the currently hopelessly polarized Congress is unlikely to enact that legislation anytime soon. There are two bills pending, one in the House and one in the Senate, that I should mention, H.R. 5566, pending in the House, which has, last time I checked, 49 co-sponsors. H.R. 5566 is called the Term Act. It would allow presidents to appoint one member of the court every 2 years, and for that member to spend 18 years in active service. It would also require current members of the court to assume senior status, and as regularly appointed members receive their commissions. In the Senate, we have S-3096 with nine co-sponsors, and S-3096 would permit presidents to appoint a member of the Supreme Court every 2 years, but allow only the nine most recently appointed members, or those appointed in the last 18 years, to hear cases from the Federal Appeals Court, which is the bulk of the High Court's docket. Members appointed earlier would be limited to hearing cases over which the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction. That is like disputes between states. They could also serve as alternates for appellate jurisdiction. Appellate jurisdiction is when the court reviews decisions by lower courts. But the bill wouldn't take effect until the next presidential term after it becomes law. It would preserve life tenure for Supreme Court members by allowing them to continue to hear original jurisdiction cases and exercise other powers after 18 years. Now, let's assume that Congress did pass a term limit statute for the Supreme Court, which is highly unlikely. But let's assume that the High Court did. There's a real risk that that same Supreme Court would strike it down and say, oh, it requires a constitutional amendment.
Marjorie, I have a hunch how you're going to evaluate another proposal, the second proposal that President Biden made in this regard. He proposed, of course, no one is above the law amendment to the U.S. Constitution. But as I say, based on what you've just said to Steve's question, what do you think the chances would be of such an amendment being adopted?
Slim to none. This would be the no one is above the law amendment would reverse the frightening Supreme Court decision in Trump v. U.S., which essentially says the president's a king above the law. You know, absolute immunity for core official acts, presumptive immunity for other official acts. So the president would have absolute immunity for official acts in exercising his constitutional powers or implementing a federal statute, presumptive immunity for acts committed in the outer perimeter of his official responsibility, whatever that means. The proposed amendment, very briefly, would state that the Constitution does not confer immunity from federal criminal indictment, trial, conviction, or sentencing for former presidents. And there's little chance of such a constitutional amendment for the same reasons that I cited for the term limits statute.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. Today, our guest is Marjorie Cohn. We are joined by Jim Lafferty, and I'm Steve Rohde. Marjorie, the third proposal that Biden has advanced is a binding code of ethics for members of the Supreme Court in the face of this scandal-ridden court we presently have. So that's part of what led to this suggestion. Tell us about it, and what would Biden's proposal entail?
It would require members of the Supreme Court to disclose gifts, refrain from public political activity, and recuse themselves from cases in which they or their spouses have financial or other conflicts of interest. Biden wrote that every other federal judge is bound by an enforceable code of conduct. And this code of ethical conduct would not require a constitutional amendment. I should say that the Supreme Court ethics have become a partisan issue with the ongoing revelations of extravagant gifts that Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito have received. Thomas has received nearly $4.2 million in gifts Recently, Alito refused to recuse himself from two cases involving Trump and the January 6th Capitol rioters after the New York Times reported that flags associated with far-right causes flew over his family homes. There is a bill pending in the Senate. It's called Supreme Court Ethics Recusal and Transparency Act, S-359, or SCRT. And S-359 would require Supreme Court members, I don't say justices, you notice, I don't think they're justices, would require Supreme Court members to adopt a code of conduct, create a mechanism to investigate alleged violations of the code of conduct and other laws, improve disclosure and transparency when a member has a connection to a party or an amicus brief pending before the court, and require members to explain their recusal decisions to the public.
My goodness, Marjorie, as we know, every presidential election year, a point that is made, depending on who your candidate is, the same point is often made from both sides, that this is going to be a very important presidential election because there may be opportunities to appoint Supreme Court justices and how important that is. In light of what you've said so far, what are the stakes in this particular election for the American people when it comes to, well, the Supreme Court in November and the presidential election?
Well, if Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are elected, Biden's proposed reforms could eventually lead to the reversal of some of the court's most egregious decisions. But the adoption of those reforms faces overwhelming obstacles. Meanwhile, if Trump's elected, he would likely have the backing of the Supreme Court as he implements the Project 2025 agenda. Also, Trump may have the opportunity to replace current members of the court and actually expand the 6-member radical supermajority. The liberal Sonia Sotomayor, who is in ill health, could be replaced by a right-winger. And some of the older right-wingers on the court, like 76-year-old Thomas and 74-year-old Alito, could be exchanged for younger members who could wreak havoc for decades to come. So between the makeup of its members and the lack of accountability, the stakes for the Supreme Court are enormous in the forthcoming presidential election.
Marjorie, how can listeners follow your work, and what can they do to support these Supreme Court reforms?
Well, my work is at truthout.org. It's a column called Human Rights and Global Wrongs. If you go down to the very bottom of the page, that my writings, videos, interviews, books, etc., are cataloged at my website, marjoriecohn.com. And I would urge people to contact your senators and congressional representatives and urge them to become co-sponsors on these bills, the ethical code of conduct for Supreme Court members and the term limits bills.
Marjorie, we're so grateful to have you back on Law and Disorder and for all the work you do every day to alert the American public to these threats to our constitutional democracy and to protect our individual rights. Thank you, Marjorie.
Want to double down on it. We so appreciate your work and joining us here on Law and Disorder.
Well, it's my pleasure, Steve and Jim. Thanks so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Israel's deadly and unrelenting assault on Gaza following Hamas's October 7 attack on Israel has had repercussions around the world. In Gaza itself, the death toll is over 40,000, and the humanitarian crisis worsens every day. In the United States, as students are headed back to campus, colleges and universities are bracing for a new round of protests and counter-protests. Israel's war in Gaza is dividing the Democratic Party, just as Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are seeking to unite their party to stop Donald Trump from returning to the White House. Recent surveys show that 48% of Americans oppose Israel's military action in Gaza, while 42% support it. But today on Law and Disorder, instead of the big picture, we're going to take a look at opposition to Israel's war in Gaza from a very personal point of view. We're joined today by Larry Hebert, a very unlikely candidate to become an outspoken protester against U.S. military support for Israel, who would gain national and international attention. Larry Hebert is a 26-year-old U.S. Air Force senior airman and avionics technician assigned to Naval Station Rota in Spain, having served 6 years so far in the military. At 10 a.m. on Easter Sunday, March 31st, 2024, on Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House, Hebert began a hunger strike during an authorized leave from his post in Spain. Shortly before his hunger strike, he joined Veterans for Peace, an organization that opposes U.S. military actions. The organization argues that U.S. weapons shipments to Israel is a violation of U.S. law. In a press release issued by Veterans for Peace, the purpose of Hebert's hunger strike was described as highlighting, quote, the plight of the starving children of Gaza, unquote. Hebert wore a sign that read, quote, active duty airman refuses to eat while Gaza starves, unquote, with a photograph of an emaciated Palestinian infant. Hebert said he was inspired by the self-immolation of 25-year-old serviceman Aaron Bushnell, who died on February 25, 2024, outside the Israeli embassy in Washington. Before he died, Bushnell declared he would, quote, no longer be complicit in the genocide in Gaza. Hebert's hunger strike lasted 9 days, but ended abruptly on April 9 when he was ordered to report immediately to Andrews Air Force Base for a return flight to his post in Spain. Hebert is pursuing release from active duty as a conscientious objector. Larry Hebert, welcome to Law and Disorder.